Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. The story is nearly two centuries old, yet it is with us still, now perhaps more vividly than ever. The rumored liaison between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings has gained a resurgence of notice, comment, and credibility with the addition of new scientific findings that strongly support it. This information, together with the narrative and circumstantial evidence long available to us, lends great force to the argument of those historians and others who have held that the Jefferson-Hemings relationship was likely. But it may be that this poignant controversy and its latest chapter only serve to present us with a new set of questions for our time, questions like, how do we construct history? And whose voices should be heard and how? And what are the deeper complexities of America's racial dilemma? And as we seek answers to these questions, we may recognize that the story is not just Jefferson's and Hemings, but ours as well. My guest is Annette Gordon Reed, author of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, An American Controversy. Annette, welcome to Dialogue.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
The preface to your book is extremely interesting, as is the book itself, and it presents us with a small African-American girl in East Texas who is already curious about history, but already suspicious about the kind of official versions of history that she is getting. Annette, you were that girl. And so I moved to ask as the first question this, since the Jefferson-Hemings controversy, as we both know, rests so much on oral accounts of history. Do you feel that as the treatment of particularly black African-American oral accounts of history, slave narratives and so forth, the treatment of them, that is really the scandal of this now almost two centuries old story?
I do, absolutely. I think that it's clear that any construction of history or construction of slavery has to include all voices. And the fact that proper heed was not taken to the black voices who spoke on this matter tells us a great deal about the way history is written, and which is something that's very, very important for us today.
Now, you've gone a long way to telling this story, and you've done it in a particularly interesting way. You're a lawyer and a legal scholar, as well as an author, and you've written a book that approaches this controversy, as I took it, in kind of a legal inquiry. In other words, you acquaint those of us who are lay people with the need to evaluate narrative evidence against a common standard, and to use evidence as to seek through evidence proof, and something that's very important for us to understand, the burden of proof.
Yes.
How would you define that term for us?
Well, the burden of proof is typically associated in law, and I think law is merely sort of is a systematized version of common sense. This notion of how you determine who is telling the truth when someone makes an accusation, what do they have to bring to the table before we'll accept their version of the story? Mm-hmm. And what I saw when I looked at the historiography on the Jefferson-Hemings story is that there seemed to be no standard, that it was just, if this makes me feel good, then I will say it's true. Things that make me feel bad, I will say are not true. And this is such an important issue, not just in terms of did Jefferson have children with a slave woman. I mean, that says something of, that's important for Jefferson biographers. But in this notion of how do you weigh the testimony of slaves? I mean, there's a logical and an analytical framework to be considered, but there's also a moral framework. And it struck me as strange that the interests of slaveholders would be, and because the interests of slaveholders were considered paramount, their words and their views and their interests, we had a very, very low standard for believing what they said. But slaves, the people who were the actual victims of slavery, had to keep coming up with higher and higher and higher standards of proof before anybody would even consider what they had to say. Mm-hmm. So there was some way of, I wanted to try to expose the fact that people who were presenting themselves as experts on this issue hadn't followed any real policy other than their own emotionalism and anxiety.
This is precisely the point that, and your use of the word of experts, I think, is key here, that those who failed this test of objectivity were, of course, those to whom we looked for, for objectivity.
Oh, absolutely. And the irony is that they were presented as the people who were the level-headed, objective folks because they had the appearance of objectivity. They were the traditional largely male white establishment of historians, well, who could believe that they would be anything other than objective? And of course, if you look at what they wrote, there's this sort of wild subjectivity and sort of anxiety-ridden analysis mm-hmm. that was sort of covered over just by our society's belief in their ultimate credibility as the ultimate arbiters of reality.
We will probe this in some depth, you and I, Annette. Let me ask you this question before we turn to that, because there has been this remarkable, very dramatic incidence of verification mm-hmm. with the scientific evidence, the DNA evidence that has come out now concerning this question. And, of course, your book treats the narrative and circumstantial story, that the case, in other words, that can mm-hmm. be built around it. Do you therefore see the book that you have written, the work that you have done, as a kind of a necessary complement to the scientific evidence, as a way of understanding the full story?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I knew when I started writing the book that because this issue was of so great importance, or seen as great importance by Jefferson historians, that no one would accept anything mm-hmm. without some sort of notion of science. But all of the major conclusions that I reach in my book were buttressed by this DNA test. So the test should be read together. The test by itself is not the answer. It's a combination mm-hmm. of all of the information that we know that's compiled in my book, and read that along with the DNA test to come mm-hmm. to an answer about this.
And now, the word that occurred to me, as I said, I've read this as a non-lawyer,
mm-hmm.
but probability. I mean, that's what this revolves around, right?
Absolutely. And that's what history revolves around. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's about relative degrees of probability. Historians were not present in the time in which they were writing. All they could go on is the available information and what level of probability does this raise it to. And so all history is about probabilities.
Now, in essence, Annette, let me set out the story in one line, as I know it, and that would be...
one line?
One line.
Okay, this should be good.
Given that so many volumes have been written, but at least to frame the next question, to say the following, it's the story of a beautiful, and I think we'd emphasize, by all accounts, her enormous grace and appeal, slave woman, young woman, who becomes the mistress of, and I think the appropriate term here is an American icon.
Yes.
In a liaison that would last 38 years, and that itself is significant, and produce several children. Now, you've spoken very eloquently about the various versions and the controversy and so forth about it, and the lack of objectivity. But there's a quality to this I want to bring out, or want to get your comment on. The disputation of what I've just said, the rejection of it, has been accompanied by an enormous degree of what I can only call vehemence. And just absolute, not just denial, but ridicule of those who would advocate that this story was true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the real question. It's not just an historical dispute. There's another quality to it. And I'd like to get your comment on that. What is that quality and why?
Well, I mean, that is a very interesting point about it, that people mm-hmm. dispute it, but that they dispute it with such passion and, as you said, ridiculing people who suggested it's true. I mean, one of the features of ridicule, I think that part of the reason for the ridicule is that there must have been some underlying understanding that this was possible. I mean, anybody who knows anything about slavery and the incidents of miscegenation during that time period had to know that at a basic level, this was something that was possible. I think that in constructing Jefferson as an American icon, as the sort of ideal hero to America, and I would have to say to white America more easily, there was a notion that if he was involved in this relationship, then he is somehow or would not be an appropriate icon in a way. I mean, seeing Jefferson as the lover of Sally Hemings was contrary to the notion that he was an admirable white person. In some ways, he becomes less than white. Connor Cruz O'Brien wrote a book about Jefferson, The Long Affair, and don't agree with a lot of what he had to say. But one thing that he said that I thought was very, very interesting, he said that in the British colonies, when white men would take up with black women in the colonies, people would say that they had gone native, that somehow they ceased to be English. And I really think that there is an element of that in this. Mm-hmm. Jefferson ceased to be a white man if he was involved with Sally Hemings, particularly for 38 years. That's a long time. Duma Malone, who wrote the 6-volume biography of Jefferson, said that near the end of his life, well, I could see it if he had done it once or twice, and which is a very curious mm-hmm. statement. It's okay for him to do this kind of thing occasionally, but the length of the relationship suggested to him that Jefferson would be foreign to him in some way. And I really do think that the vehemence behind this is that there's no way to construct him or to make him an American icon worthy of the mantle if he's involved with the black person, because he is somehow tainted. He is in part black.
Let me take a moment from our conversation, Annette, just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Annette Gordon-Reed, author of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, An American Controversy, published by the University of Virginia Press. Mm-hmm. Annette, your book presents five main stories for examination and judges the probability of each in great detail. And some of them, I think some of the stories and some of the names are going to be very new to the average reader, certainly to me. Mm-hmm. One of the key stories, they're all key, but one of the ones that struck me most vividly was that of Madison Hemings, mm-hmm. Sally's son, who in 1873 gives an interview in Ohio. I think he's resident.
Yes.
And essentially tells the story. Tells mm-hmm. my mother was Thomas Jefferson's mistress. I'm the child of that. Mm-hmm. And makes two points, well, perhaps more than two, but two that once again struck me vividly, that there was a pregnancy in France mm-hmm. while she was there as the nursemaid to one of Jefferson's youngest daughters.
Yes.
And then secondly, that there had been a promise by Jefferson to the Hemings, to Sally's children, mm-hmm. Exacted by Sally from Thomas, I would guess, that her children would be free. There would be manumission for them. Mm-hmm. What happened in both those instances? I mean, what degree of probability or proof do we get from both of those assertions?
Well, when she returns from France, there is no record of her having a child when she returned from France. Madison Hemings says that the child that she bore died. Jefferson immediately, when he returned to America in 1789, in the beginning of 1790, left Monticello and went to government and didn't keep his farm book, which is where the child would have been listed, until he came back in retirement in 1795. So there's no record of a child at Monticello named Tom, or that she had a child who survived. Mm-hmm. And Madison indeed said the child died. There's a family, the Woodsons, who believe that the child did survive and that that child is one of their ancestors and went on to take the name Woodson. So there's still a controversy about that looking at the oral history of the Woodson family. On the question of the freedom of her children, all of her children were freed when they were 21 years old. So that actually panned out. We know that for certain. Sally Hemings herself was never formally freed, but was informally freed. She went to live with her two youngest sons after Jefferson died, mm-hmm. Left Monticello. So on the question of the child after she came back from France, it's ambiguous. Madison says the child died and there's no record of him, which would make sense if the child died certainly after birth. On the freedom of her children, we know that that happened.
Now, that is, as the book points out, quite significant, because Jefferson was not known for freeing slaves.
He was not known for freeing slaves. Over the course of his life, Jefferson had hundreds of slaves. Mm-hmm. He freed 12 slaves all told in his life, but only one set of siblings. Sally Hemings' children are the only set of siblings at Monticello who went free, and the only mother with them who went free. So that, I mean, is something people who, you know, study slavery, when you see a woman and her children go free, and you have other circumstantial evidence about it, it's generally taken as pretty strong proof that the man was the father. But because this is Jefferson, mm-hmm. We have to have more. And that alone, I think if he were any other planter, if you pointed to that and saw his record about manumissions in general, the very limited notion of them, one set of siblings freed, the people that everybody said were his kids, that would be enough, but not for him.
To take one of these children and sort of vividly put emphasis on what you've said, Harriet Hemings, Sally's, there were actually two Harriet Hemings. The first had died.
Yes.
Sally gave this name again to a daughter who lived. Mm-hmm. And this daughter at some point is put on a stagecoach, I think, with $50
yes.
by Thomas Jefferson.
Yes, Jefferson instructs, Jefferson in his farm book writes, Harriet ran 22, meaning 1822, and mm-hmm. she would have been 21 years old at that point. But we actually know what happened. His overseer, in one of his reminiscences, talks about how Harriet left Monticello. Jefferson instructed his overseer to buy her a stagecoach ticket, gave her money, and put her on a coach to Philadelphia, to freedom. So right there, you know, in his farm book, he says she ran away. She didn't run away. He sent her away. And the circumstances of that are also, I think, quite suggestive of a close relationship to her.
What do the numbers tell us, Annette? I mean, 38 years is a long relationship. That'd be a long marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And Sally bore children when Thomas Jefferson was present at Monticello,
mm-hmm.
did not bear them when he was not present.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Well, she conceived children
she
when
conceived
he was present,
children,
when he was present,
mm-hmm.
and not when he was not there.
Mm-hmm.
The length of the relationship, and this, I suppose, will be the next phase in this now, as people try to talk about, well, what could this relationship have been like?
Mm-hmm.
There are no records, written records, of what their relationship was like. I have said on a number of occasions that, you know, I find it difficult to believe that someone would maintain, and mainly we're talking about Jefferson here, a purely sexual interest in a person mm-hmm. for that length of time. There were other women at Monticello. Sally Hemings had numbers of other sisters, numerous other sisters. And it just, you know, it just strikes me as strange. There must have been something there, but we don't know what it is. And that's one of the tragedies of this, is that the people who could have told you about this were never consulted. The Hemings family. The Hemings family, Madison Hemings' younger daughters lived until the 1920s. If people had talked to them about their father, did he tell you anything? Do you know? I mean, there was a chance that we could have gleaned something, but they were discounted. No one bothered to consult them, and that will be lost to us forever.
One of the reasons, one of the early reasons for rejection of this story, and it's a recurrent one actually, was rejection of one of its principal tellers, that is Mr. James Callender.
Yes.
I think Scottish-born journalist of some talent, but great vile and mm-hmm. sort of vile person. Mm. But the point you make in the book is that he wasn't the first one who told it, and it shouldn't be tied to his tale, in
yes.
a sense.
Yeah, he was not. I mean, it's very often in the popular media and even also in the history books, it's presented as if James Callender is sort of, you know, sitting in his office or under his rock or wherever, mm-hmm. making something up out of whole cloth. He was gathering information from people in Jefferson's community. And in fact, there were a couple of other sort of blind references to this in newspaper articles well before Callender wrote. So what happens, it's the old trick of making the messenger, you know, damning the messenger, saying that because this person is bad, whatever he says, no good can come from whatever he says, and that's just not true. I mean, you have to, if you're really interested in finding out about what he said, you have to go beyond his personality in order to deal with the facts. And so it's an effective technique, and it worked very, very well for very long for Callender. Just say that he's a bad guy and therefore mm-hmm. don't listen to him.
Yeah, damn the message because the
exactly.
messenger is.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I think two of the most interesting chapters in the book are those that deal speculatively with the character and personality of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, an attempt, I took it as one who, I must confess, to a love of novels, to kind of flesh them out as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the importance of this is that, particularly in those who have been such detractors of the story and denigrated it for so long, they've essentially presented in opposition to it a almost monumental figure of Jefferson. You can see him almost in marble. And I think that the argument would run he was simply too, quote, noble to engage in this, quote, crime.
Mm-hmm.
And that's balanced somewhat paradoxically by another argument that he was too racist.
Absolutely.
Too bitter. I mean, on either end of the spectrum, you would get this. But on either end of the spectrum, you're presented with a kind of a very rigid sort of almost one-dimensional kind of person.
One-dimensional person. Mm-hmm. The nobility, the supposed nobility encased him and would have protected him from the normal frailties and weaknesses of human nature. And on the other hand, racism becomes an encasement in which he is, well, use the term, protected from this kind of thing. He's too racist or too noble. And neither of those presentations understands or takes into account that you're dealing with a human being.
Yeah.
He was a man.
The word that occurs to me, again, as a lover of novels is conflicted, which mm-hmm. most of us are most of the time.
Absolutely. Ambivalent.
Ambivalent.
And, the portrayal today is of him as a hypocrite. I think the better formulation is someone who is ambivalent, as many of us are, as most of us are, about a number of things, particularly race and sex.
Race and sex in this society, certainly,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps class, too.
Absolutely.
You know, this, here I'll risk a admittedly half-formed opinion, but when I hear of accounts like this, again, as one who has loved literature, I wonder about the training of historians, quite frankly, or at least the way they approach this, because to me, it seems to me, to me it seems, that you really have to admit first off that you're dealing with a very complex creature, the human being, and that people have more than one side, and that you really have an obligation, I think, without going into fiction or without trying to say things that aren't true or defensible, mm-hmm. but to give at least some sense of the kinds of contesting motivations, if you will, that are at play in any human life at any time. But all too often I get the impression that, particularly with these, quote, iconic figures, that there is, you know, sort of one line and one line only, one set of influences, one this and one that, mm-hmm. but that this kind of messier existence that we all live is not given the credence it deserves.
Yes, absolutely, and particularly with Jefferson. Maybe perhaps Lincoln. I've read biographies of Lincoln, but I'm not as well-versed in them as I am with Jefferson. I mean, the cult of the Jefferson scholar is as strong as the cult of Jefferson in some way, to be able to say, I know him. And it's easier to know someone if you reduce them down to, you know, mm-hmm. two or three elemental things and master them as if he is a language. Jefferson is, you can know Jefferson the way you know Sanskrit. And somebody brings you a line of Latin, you could look at it and say, oh, no, that's not Sanskrit, that's Latin. And that you could do it with Jefferson. And that's the way he's really handled here, because there's an enormous benefit and prestige being associated with the notion of being a Jefferson scholar. And I know him. Mm-hmm. as almost a figure of, like he's Jesus in a way. And that prevents the kind of thing that you're talking about, the more complex view where you admit, I don't know, or this is something that I don't understand about him, but it's here. Yeah. And I haven't figured out how to put it together. Mm-hmm. But no one is going to say that if you have the impulse to say, I know him.
You know, I'm smiling because I'm reminded, even as you speak, that I believe it's Isaac Jefferson's account, a slave's account, mm-hmm. that says he didn't even look like his portrait.
Yes, and he said that he was not nearly as handsome as his portrait makes him out to be. Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I mean, this is a mm-hmm. person who lived a long time, wrote a lot of stuff, was mm-hmm. very enormously intelligent, and therefore enormously complex.
Yeah.
But the irony of it is, in order to say that you know this person, you must be even smarter than he is. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's to make him into sort of a lab rat that you figured out suggests that you must be smarter than he mm-hmm. is in order to do that. And I think that there's enormous desire to sort of an academic benefit or need to do that, even though it doesn't produce a very good picture of him overall.
What happens when we try to get a sense of Sally Hemings that is not simply influenced by Gone with the Wind or anything of that ilk, but treats her as somebody who's complex, who has... And, you know, if you think about it logically, you could have her own calculations to make and things like this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've running into enormous trouble now. As I say, we move from the did it happen phase to most, I think, reasonable people saying, look, you know, if we don't have historical proof for this, we don't have mm-hmm. historical proof for many things. As we move from that phase to trying to reconstruct what the relationship was like, you have to reconstruct Sally or have some construction of Sally. And I'm sort of encountering, I think, it's some concern on the part of blacks, and I think women, and this notion that she may have had any motivations. It's almost as if her motives don't matter. The fact of her enslavement mm-hmm. is sort of trumps everything.
That's one-dimensional, too.
And it's one-dimensional as well, mm-hmm. and I understand the impetus for saying that is because you don't want to turn... I think there's the concern that you don't want to minimize the horrors of slavery, but I don't think by looking at individual lives, when you turn the focus on an individual person by paying attention to them in a serious way and looking at the nuances in their lives, that you are, in fact, minimizing slavery. I don't think that that's true at all.
Well, I was going to say, if you it requires effort mm-hmm. and a degree of, you know, work, of course, but if you can understand the nuances and the subtleties of those endless calculations mm-hmm. of both slavery and segregation as well, I mean, this is not ancient in that sense, and know the kinds of... things people felt they had to do because of the situation they were in, mm-hmm. It seems to me you don't get a refutation of the evils of slavery in mm-hmm. Sally's case at all. You get an understanding of perhaps it's even more devilish and evil.
Oh, absolutely.
Because what people are forced to do.
Because at some level, if you play that, you know, the card, the sense that, well, it's their enslavement that matters, and they could all have been sold. I mean, that's the phrase. Well, it doesn't make any difference whether she exercised a choice or not, because she could have been sold. But then you end up like Malone and Peterson and the writers who wrote about Jefferson's life and left his slaves out of it. What difference does it make? Why write about people who have no agency, mm-hmm. who are not influencing the scene at all? And that's not what's intended, but that's basically what you end up with, people mm-hmm. who are ciphers, people who didn't help shape their surroundings. And she definitely did. And if you look at Sally Hemings and think about what her son wrote about her, she evidently extracted a promise from Jefferson that he would free her children mm-hmm. and that she would live a life at Monticello free from the most extreme vagaries of slavery. And by all accounts, that's exactly what happened. And that may have been the best that she could do. And the fact that she was a slave woman and had to make that kind of bargain is a tragedy. But to say that she didn't make it or that it couldn't have been in her contemplation, I think, mm-hmm. Destroys her humanity.
Annette, in conclusion of our conversation, perhaps a couple of questions occur to me. Actually, many more, but but these two in particular, your own feelings about Thomas Jefferson. You, I know, participated, I believe, a few years ago in a conference that kind of presented him for trial.
Yes, it was sort of a mock trial,
Thomas Jefferson.
There was a vote taken at the Association of the Bar. Yes,
mm-hmm. Does his hypocrisy trump his contributions, or vice versa? And I mm-hmm. think you voted that his contributions should be upheld.
Oh yes, I people ask me this question, and I typically answer. I really do believe that the contributions of Jefferson outweigh the problems. I feel that we haven't come to grips with him yet because we haven't had an honest appraisal of him. And I'm hoping that that's what I'd like to be a part of, and I'm hoping that that's what will come in the future. The contributions to the Declaration of Independence, the University of Virginia, this notion of questing for scientific knowledge, and giving us a vision of ourselves that I think is a good one. There are bad sides to it, the racism, obviously, and I would never downplay that. But on balance, I think that he belongs on Mount Rushmore. Hmm. And he certainly, with all of his imperfections, has been of use to black people. I mean, Frederick Douglass, David Walker, through W.E.B. Du Bois, through all the years, have used Jefferson's standard to extract a lot in terms of bringing black Americans hmm. into the American scene. So that's not what he intended, but he's been useful. And that's good.
Annette Gordon-Reed, I want to thank you very much for a wonderful conversation.
Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Annette Gordon-Reed, author of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, An American Controversy. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Associate producer is Karen Reed, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is a presentation of PRI, Public Radio International, and is produced by the Woodrow Wilson Center in collaboration with the Smithsonian Institution. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.